There is a strange mixture of excitement and remorse that comes to individuals and to a family on moving day. You know that the decision has been made and there's no changing of it. There's not the idea that the decision ought to be any different. The travel arrangements are all taken care of and everything is packed. You know that time when everything is loaded up and then you take that last look around the house, around the apartment before you leave. The place, it looks sterile and empty. Oh, at least that's the way it would look to a stranger. But to you, it looks different. Because even though the furniture is gone and even though the curtains may be down, the place is still nevertheless filled with memories. Good and bad, but most of them fond and precious memories. It's the place where you lived so very long, the place where you loved and the place where you laughed, so that you can stand there and look over in the corner of a room and say, that's the place where our now full-grown son took his first toddling steps. Or you can walk upstairs and you can see the teeth marks on the railing outside the bedroom where your now teenage daughter first exercised her teeth on the furniture. You can look around the house and you can see reminder after reminder of all the things that have made up life. And then you walk outside and the trees that were planted as seedlings are now as big as the house. And you look down the street in each and every direction and you realize that for blocks and for miles are the homes and the families of the people that you count as your friends. Those that you know well, and those that you trust and trust you, those that you love and who love you. And you think about the future, and you say, yeah, the future is great. I have no doubt that I'm doing what I ought to be doing, and I know there'll be a new home, and there'll be new friends, and there'll be new things to do, and there'll be new experiences. But somehow, there's still that lingering emotion to that place that for so long has been that special place, that place that we've called home. And there's also the recognition that we'll probably never return there. Oh, maybe to visit. But it can never be the same again. There's never any way to go back, to turn back the clock or the pages of our biography or history and live again the way we have lived before. Jacob was 130 years old when it came time for him to move. He had moved lots of times in his life before that, too many times. In fact, his change of address had been very frequent. Each time for him had been more difficult than the time before. This time, in a sense, was different because this time the move, well, it just had to be. He couldn't stay there in Hebron. There was no food. The family would die. And besides that, over across the miles in Egypt was his son Joseph, whom he yearned to see, a man whom he loved with all his heart and from whom he had been separated for 22 years. The decision was made, and it wasn't time for Jacob to have doubts. He couldn't have doubts. There was no place for any doubts. And so he left, everything packed up, and turned and looked for the final time at the old homestead in Hebron, and then turned back and went down the caravan route where he had watched many, many times the traders walk and travel on horseback. He had watched his sons come and go in that very trip to Egypt, and he made that journey himself. The entourage that night, or a couple of nights later, camped at a place called Beersheba. And maybe that doesn't seem significant when we just read it as part of his itinerary. But it was significant because Beersheba was the last outpost of Canaan. It was on the edge of the Negev. Looking back, you could see what normally was a land of milk and honey, although it had been decimated during that time of famine. But looking ahead, you could see nothing but the Negev, the Sinai, a desolate and forsaken place, barren even in the best of times.
And we might think that Jacob had second thoughts because he had difficulty leaving the beautiful place and going into the unknown. But it wasn't melancholy that stopped him. He stopped because at Beersheba, he suddenly had that shocking realization that he hadn't really checked this out with God. He had made the move, he had scheduled the plan, he had done all these things, but he really didn't have a sure word from the Lord that he was doing what he ought to do. And so he could travel no further until he received God's sanction. It didn't make any difference what his family thought. It didn't make any difference what the Egyptians, who were part of the caravan, thought. It didn't make any difference when they were expected at their new home. It didn't make any difference what the supplies were nor how long they would last. It simply didn't matter that other people might be concerned about a delay. He needed to know what God thought. And as he reflected on that, he reflected and remembered so many important things that up until that point, he had forgotten about. And so he went to sleep that night in one of those fitful sleeps, that thing where you wake and you sleep and you go back and forth and you toss and you turn. It was difficult. But then in the middle of the night, he heard a voice. Jacob? Jacob? He said, "Here am I." He had recognized the voice. It's a voice that no one who has ever heard it could ever forget. He hadn't heard it for over 20 years now, since the last time he was at Bethel. But he knew it well because it was the voice of Jehovah God himself. The voice continued and said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will there make you a great nation. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes." Everything was different now for Jacob. Things were changed. Now he could go. Everybody could wake up. Let's get going. Let's get the caravan moving. Let's get the oxen ready. Let's get everything packed up, the supplies in place. We're on our way to Egypt. Maybe they didn't realize the change that had taken place, that the man who had paused to pray and to sacrifice had heard again from God. And as he traveled down the caravan route that next morning, he was a different man. He was changed. There were no longer doubts or anxieties. His troubled heart had been displaced, replaced with a confident heart. God was there, and there was no more cause for worry or for fear. And then that embryonic nation of 66 people got near the borders of Egypt. The signs along the way and the other caravans that they passed said it wouldn't be much farther to go. And so they chose from their midst one, Judah, who would be their representative and precede them into the land of Goshen, which they anticipated would be their home. He went ahead and he prepared the way. And then they all arrived. And as they looked at the land of Goshen, they saw that it was indeed a handsome place. Even amidst the widespread famine, Goshen's beauty and its fertility, it showed through so it could be clearly seen. But the excitement of the place, it wasn't much. Because the excitement of the place was dwarfed by the subsequent excitement in Jacob's heart that soon he would see his son, Joseph. All that had been said when Joseph arrived was obviously true. Clearly, he was an important man. It was even more than he had anticipated. Joseph was a man of presence. You know what presence is, sort of the feeling that that person's there, that person is significant. Joseph was obviously powerful and clearly handsome. He was obviously wealthy and filled with authority. And the Egyptians and the Hebrews alike, the Egyptians who knew so much about him and the Hebrews who were directly related to him, they were all struck by awe when they saw Joseph, Zaphnath-Paneah, the grand vizier of Egypt. But for those two men, Joseph and Jacob, there was a difference to their eyesight. They didn't see the land of Goshen. They didn't see the crowds of Egyptians that were surrounding the important people. They didn't notice so much the other relatives. They weren't impressed by the royal robes. They didn't care that Jacob was dirty from a long and dusty journey. All of those things slipped out of focus for them because they set eyes one upon the other. Joseph, you recall through his story, had always been a man, a very proper man of protocol and custom. He always kept the appropriate social distance. He was careful, even when his brothers were involved, that he ate at a separate table because Egyptians just didn't eat with other people, especially an important Egyptian like Joseph. But at this point, he ignored all matters of rank and normal social distance. He ran to his father, and he threw his arms around him, and he hugged him, and he wept, and he wept, and he wept, and he wept, and he wept. Until those that stood around were a little embarrassed. They thought, well, you know, it's one thing to, isn't he getting a little carried, isn't this a little much? But Joseph didn't care. He was more than two ordinary men. Joseph and Jacob were father and son. Even more than that, they were each other's best friends. And even more than that, they were both men of God. They loved one another dearly, and their once frequent embrace had been interrupted for 22 years. But then there was business to be taken care of, matters that had to be handled. There had to be an introduction at the court of Pharaoh. There had to be carefully prepared and worded and rehearsed questions and answers so that these Hebrews who were used to living out in the wilderness would know how to dress and behave in the court of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And so it was all planned and prepared out, and the day of meeting came. And Pharaoh was pleased. He was glad to meet Joseph's family. He was delighted to have them live in Goshen. In fact, he even went so far as saying, if your family's so good at herding sheep, why don't you take care of my livestock, my sheep, my cattle? You can be foreman over my herds. And then there was the final introduction. Jacob, the 130-year-old patriarch, was introduced to Pharaoh. The man of politics and power treated the man of God with great respect. But you couldn't help but notice the contrast between the two. A sharp and vivid contrast. Pharaoh could give all of this, life and wealth and land, all these things to Jacob and his family. Jacob, by this time, even though he had once been a wealthy man, had nothing by comparison. What could he give in return to Pharaoh? But you see, he gave something far more valuable than the land of Goshen or food in time of famine. He gave his blessing. His blessing in the name of Jehovah, the God of Israel. Well, the story continues. Joseph got them all settled. And then Joseph got back to his job, the running of the nation of Egypt. The famine continued just as had been predicted. The people were fed. And Joseph not only watched out for them, but he watched out for the interest of Pharaoh. And he strengthened the central rule of the nation of Egypt until Pharaoh eventually owned all the land and all the livestock and all the people in his direct possession and ownership, or at least almost all of them. And the people didn't seem to mind. They recognized that Joseph and Pharaoh had their best interests at heart. And everything then went great. The family of Jacob, the budding nation of Israel, it was united and it grew and it prospered. Jacob thought that the day he arrived in Egypt was the day he was going to die. In fact, he said it. He said, when I see my son Joseph and at last we're reunited, that will be the last day of my life. I will have lived to see all I need to, and then I will go to be with my family. I'll go with those that have preceded me to be with the Lord. Well, God instead gave him an additional 17 happy years of life. 17 prosperous and exciting years. But then when he was 147 years old, he knew that this time indeed it really was the end. The conclusion of his life had indeed come. And so he began to make final preparations. Imagine it. 147 years old. Imagine the things that he learned in that nearly century and a half of living and walking with God. A man who communed with God, talked to him, they talked right out loud, just as we talk to one another. A man who knew God by name, and a man whose name was changed by God. A man who had been in the pits of defeat and had soared to the highest mountaintops of victory. What a lifetime, and what lessons he learned in that lifetime. Lessons that we might expect to be lost in antiquity. But lessons, wisdom, experience, which have by God's grace been handed down through the centuries, so that out of his story we also can learn, because God shares with us his lessons of a lifetime, of nearly a century and a half. And tells us that we don't have to go through all of the things that Jacob went through. We can learn Jacob's lessons just handed and taught to us. Like the first lesson. The lesson that he learned back there in chapter 46, verses 1 through 7. The lesson to talk to God about all of life's decisions. Jacob had quickly gotten excited about the prospect of moving to Egypt. After all, what else could he do? Famine? And that was where his son Joseph was. It was so good. It was so obviously providential that that's exactly what he should do. I mean, if we brought together a committee of the wisest people in our church or the wisest people in his family, everyone would have agreed. God's hand is in this. It's the thing to do. And so he set out for Egypt. But you remember he stopped. He stopped at Beersheba because he had to reflect on some things that had happened in his family before, lessons from previous generations. He thought back to the account that's recorded in chapter 12 of Genesis on how his grandfather Abraham went down to the land of Egypt and there fell into sin. He mustn't forget that. And then how his father Isaac, in chapter 26, verse 2, was strictly and specifically forbidden by God to enter the land of Egypt. And then he also remembered that God, in an explicit promise, had told him that the land of Canaan and Palestine was his for the having, to be passed down to every generation. It's no wonder he had doubts. Abraham there fell into sin. Isaac was forbidden to go, and he was told that the land that he was to live in was a land other than the land of Egypt. That's why he could go no farther. So that no matter how good a deal it was to move to Egypt, and no matter how serious the consequences of staying in Canaan might be, Jacob could not proceed without a clear word from his Lord. Jacob had learned from past mistakes and successes, that he had no choice but to stop. He had no choice but to pray. He had no choice but to sacrifice. Basically, he had no choice but to go to God and wait for what God had to say. He could not move ahead without God's blessing. And that's the lesson that God has for us to learn. Now, we sometimes stumble through life's experience as if the lesson had not been given to us. But God reminds us again that we must always seek his approval in life's decisions. You know well that once you or I have acknowledged the Lordship of Jesus Christ in our lives, we are no longer free to do anything without His approval. But there's a temptation that comes sometimes once a day that tells us, hey, it's okay. Just move ahead. All the evidence is there. Everything indicates that this is what you're supposed to do. It's especially a great temptation when it seems like the green go sign has appeared everywhere. Really, isn't that the providence of God in our lives? And yet the battlefields of Christian experience are strewn with well-meaning Christians who have been so sure that God wanted them to marry, and so sure that God wanted them to start into some new ministry, and so positive that God wanted them to move, and so certain that God wanted them to undertake some project. And then they tell the sad tale 6 months or 6 years later that says, it all seemed right then. So right that it didn't seem necessary to have a clear-cut go-ahead from God. So I just did it, and it was wrong. It was the wrong job. It was the wrong marriage. It was the wrong ministry. It was the wrong project. But it's too late now to go back. The lesson is that no matter how sure you may be about either the monumental or the routine decisions of life, talk those decisions over with God before you proceed. Wait for His sure word. Talk to Him about the expenditures of your income and capital. Don't assume that because you have given 10% to His work that the other 90% is yours to do with as you please. That's not Christian stewardship. Talk to Him before you make a move into that new house, even if it's only 3 blocks away. Talk to Him and see if He is calling you to that new neighborhood to be there His ambassador as clearly as He was calling Jacob and his family from Canaan into Egypt. Talk to Him about that promotion or that new job, even though it seems that it's a better opportunity to witness, and even though it's a lot more money, and even though it has more status and prestige. Talk to Him. Maybe you're already at the brink of the land and at Beersheba and all the decisions have been made. Nevertheless, it may be the time to stop and to pray and to sacrifice and to talk to God and make sure that His sanction, His approval goes with that decision. Isn't it great that you and I can learn the lesson without having to go through all of life? We don't have to wait until we're 13 decades old. We can learn it from Jacob now. We can learn it and we can live it this week, that we can talk to God and we must talk to God about all the decisions of life. And there's another lesson that God wants us to learn. The lesson that knowing God is better than being a king. It's in Genesis 47, verses 7 to 12, that we have the heart of Jacob's appearance before Pharaoh. Quite a comparison it was. Must have been a fascinating scene to see the old man, probably with weakened body and stooped shoulders, walk with his shepherd's garments and stand before Pharaoh. I'm sure a lot of people wondered what was going on. Some probably thought it was stupid, and some probably laughed, and others mocked. The comparison was sharp. There was Pharaoh, royalty, and Jacob, a commoner. Pharaoh, he was so rich, you couldn't count it. Remember when you were a kid, you read the Uncle Scrooge comic books, and he had a great big bin that was filled with money. He had to have a tractor to push it around. And Pharaoh was so loaded that there couldn't be any comparison to anybody else in the world. Jacob? Oh, he had some money, but by comparison, he was relatively poor. Pharaoh? Powerful beyond our imagination in a democratic society. He could, at the snap of fingers, say, you live, you die. He'd done it. He'd done it with his own household servants, with the baker and, you know, those that were his attendants, his butler. He had made that life and death decision as a matter of whim. Jacob, he had no authority, no power. He was a weak man, not only in what he could do, but also physically in his own body. Pharaoh was younger. Jacob was obviously much older. Pharaoh was famous. Jacob was unknown outside of a small handful of people. Pharaoh was the ruler of the greatest nation in the world, and Jacob didn't even have a passport. He didn't even have citizenship in any land, anywhere. If you've ever been in the presence of a very important and very rich and very famous and very powerful person, you know a little bit of what Jacob felt. It's an uncomfortable feeling that somehow you seem to be ant-size in comparison to that person that is so big and important. Quite a comparison. But the conclusion that we and the Word of God reach is that Jacob was the man far better off. He might not have had the wealth and the power and the importance, but he had something far, far better. For Jacob knew God. Jacob and God had talked together. Jacob knew that his personal relationship with the Lord, the God of the universe, was far superior to anything and everything that Pharaoh had. Sure, Pharaoh could give land, and Pharaoh could give food, and Pharaoh could give safe passage. But Jacob could bestow the blessing of the living God. There's no possible way that Jacob would have traded. No way. He would not have traded what he had for all of what Pharaoh had. For you see, for Jacob, knowing God was far better than being a king. What about you? Would you trade? Would you trade your life in Jesus Christ for all the things that our eyes tend to look upon? Would you trade Jesus Christ for better health, or for more money or position, or a better job, for popularity at school or importance in your profession? I trust not. For if such a trade could be made, you would stoop to exchanging eternal wealth for a horrible and fleeting earthly poverty. After all, we have been called like Jacob to be the friends of God, and when called to be God's friend, who could be so stupid as to stoop to be a king? Now, God wants us to learn that lesson, and learn it well. I believe that this lesson will cure your envy. I believe that it will correct your covetousness. I believe that it will erase from your heart discontent that can eat you alive. You will discover that in Jesus Christ you already have everything that you could ever need or want. So don't have to go through a lifetime to learn the lesson. Learn it from the biography of Jacob. The lesson that knowing God is far, far better than being a king. And then a third lesson, a hard lesson. It's in verse 9 of chapter 47. The lesson that Jacob learned over more than 100 years. The lesson that life's journey is not easy. That life is difficult even for the saints. Jacob was not submitting to paranoid pessimism. When standing before Pharaoh, he said those difficult words, "Few and evil, or few and unhappy, have been the days of the years of my life." Jacob didn't live as long as the other patriarchs, nowhere near as long as Noah, but not as long as Isaac or Abraham either. That's because life's burdens took their toll upon Jacob. His life was not easy. As a young man, relatively young man, he was compelled to flee from his boyhood home. You remember it. He went to Padan Aram into Mesopotamia. And there he was treated wretchedly and deceived by his own father-in-law in that strange country. He encountered the hostility of his brother, his twin brother, who set out to murder him. You think you have problems in your life?
His daughter, his only daughter, was raped. His sons, two of them, Simeon and Levi, were murderers. Another of them, Reuben, committed incest with one of Jacob's own wives. You think that's all? That's only part of it. The one woman in life that he loved with all his heart was Rachel. And she died as they traveled, and he had to bury her in a makeshift grave along the road. The son that he loved with all his heart that replaced Rachel in his affection disappeared at 17 years old, and he assumed that he was dead. And then he also thought he loved the replacement, the man that he loved, and replacement for him, Benjamin, was also lost to him. Life was hard, very hard. It's no wonder that Jacob calls his life a pilgrimage, for it was often a journey over very rough roads. Did he have regrets? Would he do it over again and do it differently? Not if God would not go with him. There were no regrets because the issue of life, Jacob had learned, the issue of life is not the journey, but the destination. Jacob's name is included in Hebrews chapter 11 in that catalog of the great men and women of faith. And in Hebrews 11, 13 to 16, the essence of it is captured. These all died in faith, not having received what was promised. Did you hear that? Not having received what was promised, but having seen it and greeted it from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles in the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. Sure, life was tough for Jacob. He was never promised that it would be easy. But the continued presence of God with him eased and made tolerable the difficulties. And the promise of God's final destination made the journey worthwhile. You may be one of those 20th century saints, Christians, and there is a multitude of us who think that the Christian life ought to be all smooth sailing. There ought never be a bump or a chuck hole in the road. There ought never be a problem that appears. But remember something. Remember that God never called us to a life of ease. That he never promised us freedom from problems. That he never promised any kind of a smooth journey. That instead he promised something far better. He promised himself. And he promised his heavenly home at the destination. You see, we sometimes assume that the solution to our present problems will be smoothed out. I do that. I think as soon as I can get this matter straightened out, I'll be home free. But then I learn year after year that when this problem's solved, that there is some new rough spot in the road. So don't be deceived. There will be new difficulties, and there will be new problems. There will be further conflicts, and there will be later worries. But learn the lesson. Learn the lesson that even though life's journey is not easy, God is sufficient for every step along the way. Read the biographies of the great saints, men like Jacob, but also read the story of Moses, read the biography of Isaiah, find out about Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, and catalog the difficulties experienced by the apostles Peter and Paul. You'll quickly discover their lives were not easy. And if you're willing to go beyond that and do what is one of the greatest exercises in the Christian life, read the biographies of the saints through the years. Discover the story of David Livingstone, who suffered from difficulties, disease, who was attacked by a lion and had his arm mangled in Africa. Get the story of Charles Haddon Spurgeon. We read his morning and evening devotionals,
And we lift him up as the prince of preachers, which indeed he was. But sometimes we neglect to find that he was a man often dipping into the deepest of depression for days at a time. Or read the biography of J. Hudson Taylor, the founder of the China Inland Mission, and find there, even though he was a great man of faith and a pioneer for Jesus Christ, that he had severe and continuing conflicts with his fellow workers who thought that his strategy, his approach of missions was wrong. Or the next time we sing a hymn that has in the upper left-hand corner, Fanny Crosby. Don't just enjoy the words, but remember that this great saint lived her life and died in the darkness of being blind. Now don't be discouraged by this lesson, but learn it. Learn the lesson that life's journey is not easy, but that God is sufficient for every step of the way. One last lesson from Jacob's story. It's in chapter 47, verses 29 to 31. It's actually the end of that section. It's the lesson to trust God for the future, to believe God's promises, even if you're not going to see the fulfillment of them. God had promised Jacob that he would father a great nation, and he was about to die, and there were only about 100 of them. God had promised Jacob the land of Canaan, and here they were a long ways from home in a different land, and there were no prospects of getting the land of Canaan. God had promised that he would someday return to that land that was to be his and his descendants. But now he was dying and there wasn't energy or time to get back there. So at the brink of the grave, Jacob had little more than promises. Just promises. Nevertheless, he fully and completely believed and trusted God to fulfill every detail of every promise. He called his son Joseph to his bedside, and he said, "My son, put your hand there on my thigh and make me a promise that you'll bury my bones back at the cave of Machpelah, back in Canaan." You see, he wanted to be buried where he knew that the promises of God would someday be fulfilled. Jacob believed God. He believed God as if that handful of members of his clan were already a mighty nation of millions. He believed God as if that now Canaanite-filled land had been conquered and was totally populated by Israeli cities. He believed God even for those things which he could not see and those things which he could in no way affect. He believed God as if it had already happened. You see, he trusted God for the future. He had that much confidence that he didn't have to see it, but that he knew God would take care of it. Do you have that kind of faith and that kind of trust in God? Maybe you're pushing towards retirement, and you're worried about how you're going to make it financially. Can you trust the God who has promised to meet your every need? Can you trust him for that part of your future? Or maybe you're concerned, as many people are, for their adult children who have no interest in the things of God. Can you trust God that even if you die and do not see them return to the Lord, that someday, even after your life is over, then they will? Are you perplexed about the problems of society, the devaluation of the dollar and the ravages of inflation and the social injustices that occur and the advances of communism? Are you worried about the future so that when you watch the news at nighttime you get uptight over it? Then trust God for the future. Learn the lesson to trust him even for those things you cannot affect and even for those things that you will never see. Remembering that the author to the Hebrews so defined faith, that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Those are four critically important lessons. Let me have your mind for just one more moment. We live in a day of spectacular scientific and technological advances. We have all kinds of things, diagnostic and therapeutic radiological techniques and sharp, clear color televisions and strong and high skyscrapers. You know why we have all those things? Because of what's been done by previous generations. Because in previous generations, somebody invented the wheel, and somebody else discovered the X-ray, and somebody else developed a vacuum tube, and another person the principles of structural steel use. It's because of what other generations have done that we have built on that we have what we have today. Now, so it is with life. We ought to be living our lives the best. We need not make the mistakes or have to make the discoveries of previous generations. We, if any generation, ought to soar to the highest spiritual heights. We, if any people, ought to walk closest to Jesus Christ, because we can learn the lessons of previous generations. Don't make the mistakes. Don't have to stumble through life as if the lessons were not known. Learn all of them. Particularly remember the lessons from the 147-year journey of Jacob. The lesson to talk to God about all your decisions. The lesson that knowing God is better than being a king. The lesson, the hard lesson, that life's journey is not easy.